kind of rare, I think, to find a location that is a first-rate research facility, but also offers the public the chance to pause and absorb the beauty of nature. And for those of us lucky enough to be familiar with it, the UW Arboretum is a place to glimpse what Wisconsin likely used to look like, to appreciate the wildlife that make its home there, and to learn about the native plants of our area. Franklin Court is an emeritus professor of English from Northern Illinois University. He now makes his home here in Madison, and he's the author of a new book you're going to really like. It's called Pioneers of Ecological Restoration, The People and Legacy of the University of Wisconsin Arboretum. It's published by University of Wisconsin Press, and great to have Frank. Welcome. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today.
Nice to be here, Larry.
Let's talk about the Arboretum. Sort of those who aren't familiar with it, where is the Arboretum located? What does it consist of today? For those who haven't got a chance to visit.
Well, the Arboretum's on the south end of Lake Wingra.
Mm-hmm.
It's
1200
in Madison. It's only a couple miles from the campus south, and not far from Monroe Street for anybody who happened to be wandering around Monroe Street. Mm-hmm. A short drive up the road brings them to the Arboretum. It's 1,260 plus acres. It's in two parts. One part, the largest part, is the part north of the Beltline, but there's a part south of the Beltline that's called the Grady Tract. Mm-hmm. And the Arboretum is collection of native plant communities, but it is also an arboretum in the sense that Longenecker Gardens is a botanical garden.
Yeah.
And it is really, it's about 40, 50 acres, 35 acres, I think. But it really is the part of the arboretum that is the arboretum.
Yeah.
The rest of the arboretum is a rather large nature preserve with a variety of plant communities.
Your preface of the book with a statement that you say it's no exaggeration to say that the reputation of the University of Wisconsin Arboretum in Madison is closely entwined with the evolving global history of restoration ecology. Why is that so central to the book?
Well, that's central to the book because it was the vision that the founders of the Arboretum had. They didn't call it ecological restoration back in the 1930s, but they had a vision that what they wanted to do with this land, this worn-out land, was initially five parcels of land, 245 acres, or six parcels of land, excuse me, on the extreme south and west end of Lake Wingra. And what they wanted to do with it was to restore it. And they wanted to restore it because they wanted to reforest part of it,
mm-hmm,
because they were interested in perhaps connecting with the Forest Products Laboratory, and that would provide an experimental forest preserve here in Madison. There was also the possibility for government funding. They also wanted to restore the central part of that parcel of land, which was a worn-out pasture. They wanted to do it because they wanted to restore a prairie,
mm-hmm,
a tall grass prairie, in a spot where it perhaps had existed at one time. The reason they wanted to do that was because they wanted to provide the people visiting the Arboretum eventually with a sample of what Wisconsin looked like, this part of Wisconsin, this part of the Midwest might have looked like in the middle of the 19th century, pre-settlement. And so they decided that they would restore a prairie. But there was also another reason why they wanted to restore that prairie. Because when the Arboretum was founded, it was founded as, and this is important, it was founded as a forest preserve, arboretum, and wildlife refuge.
Yeah.
And so they were thinking very seriously of turning the Arboretum into a wildlife refuge. And this, in particular, appealed to Aldo Leopold.
Oh.
And that's why they hired Aldo Leopold in 1933. as the professor of game management. His he split his duties with the campus as a as the director of the or as the chair of the game management department, the first professor of game management, by the way, and he was the research director of the Arboretum. Leopold wanted to create habitat, what had been here, for migratory birds. And that was another one of the reasons why they decided to concentrate on restoration. The ecological end of it comes in, of course. They were aware of that at the beginning, but it comes in much later when people begin to realize that if you're going to restore land, you've got to restore it with an eye toward the ecosystem.
Yeah.
You don't just restore the land. You restore everything else that's there. You work on the soil, the trees. You concern yourself with the animals, the insect, the water, and, of course, you know, even the air, anything that's part of the ecosystem.
Franklin Court, our guest today. Frank, an emeritus professor of English from Northern Illinois University and author of this new book we're talking about, Pioneers of Ecological Restoration, The People and Legacy of the University of Wisconsin Arboretum. Have you visited the Arboretum as you listen in? What stands out to you about the Arboretum? Do you have a favorite area of the Arboretum? We'd love to hear from you. And your experiences there. Or if you have questions, maybe you've never been there, just have some questions about it, join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org, or go to my Facebook page, at The Larry Mueller Show, and you can post a question or a comment there. We also have a link to the book, so if you... Click on the link. It'll take you right to UW Press, the publishers of the book. But love to hear from you. So give us a call or shoot us an email or go to my Facebook page. In the first half of the first decade of the 20th century, John Nolan, who was that lauded East Coast landscape architect, was brought to Madison by John Olin of the Madison Park and Pleasure Drive Association, and talk about why they brought him in.
Well, they knew the city fathers, you know, the people who had built this city, realized that Madison was an attractive city, and it was appealing to people, and the population was increasing. But they wanted Madison to be a beautiful city, and so they decided to hire John Nolan. He came to Madison, and his responsibility, what they asked him to do, was to design a future for the city of Madison that would turn Madison from an attractive city into a beautiful city. And so he came, and he came about 1908 and spent a couple of years here off and on. He would return to Boston where he lived. But he spent enough time to finally put enough material together for a book that he called Madison, a Model City, that was published in 1911. And in it, he proposed plans for the city that would turn it into this beautiful, beautiful city that these city fathers envisioned and had hoped for. And one of the recommendations that he made was that since the university and the city were so close together, and the city was so very fortunate to have the university on the west end of the city, that the city would benefit, and so would the university, if the university and the city decided to put in a botanical garden, if they also decided to put in an arboretum. And he had in mind at the time, this was 1911, of course, the area just west of the university in the Eagle Heights area. His book, called Madison, a Model City, became a reference book for people who were interested in expanding the city and in improving its appearance. And it continued on for 10 years as a very important reference book. And one of the people who was very, very heavily influenced by Madison, a Model City, was, of all people, Michael Olbrich. And Olbrich called it his civic Bible. He carried a map from that book with him almost constantly. Judge Marvin Rosenberry, a good friend of his, made that observation, and it's sort of documented. And so when Olbrich decided that he was thinking of perhaps the possibility of putting something like a park, or perhaps an arboretum, possibly, on the western and southwestern end of Lake Wingra, he knew that he had that John Nolan had provided him with the inspiration, and he had John Nolan's recommendation in mind. They couldn't do it in the Eagle Heights area because the land had been sold.
Yeah.
So Olbrich looked south, and he looked slightly west, and found the area over by Lake Wingra.
And acquiring that land was a kind of a long and arduous process.
Yes, indeed.
And who did he lead? Who led that effort? I forgot now.
Well, it was led by Michael Olbrich. It was an interesting story. It was 1921 when Olbrich managed to sell the land he had acquired on the east shore of Lake Monona to the Madison City Council for $50,000. He took the $50,000. In 1922, he formed an organization called the Madison Parks Foundation. And he, with the $50,000, he planned to purchase land for another park. And he turned to a very, very good friend of his, who was Paul Stark.
Yeah.
And he and Paul Stark together. Paul Stark is one of the most unheralded people in this story. And so that's why I'm pleased to have had the opportunity to recognize Paul Stark's role in the history of the Arboretum.
Street named after him.
No. But Olbrich, of course, got his $50,000 from selling the land that is now Olbrich Park and Olbrich Botanical Gardens. But then he turned his eyes toward the southwest over by Lake Wingra, and he and Paul Stark started to acquire land over there because they thought it would be a good place for a park. And over a period of, from 1922 until, 1929, it took them that long to acquire six parcels of land, and which amounted to 245 acres, which marked the start of the Arboretum.
Our guest today, as we talk about the University of Wisconsin Arboretum, Franklin Court, Emeritus Professor of English and author of Pioneers of Ecological Restoration, the People and Legacy of the University of Wisconsin Arboretum. Join in with your questions and comments at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking about the University of Wisconsin Arboretum today with Frank Court. Franklin is author of Pioneers of Ecological Restoration. That's the first part of the title of his book. And it deals with the history of the UW Arboretum. It's a really fascinating read, and I'm glad to have him on today with us. You can join in if you have a question about the Arboretum or maybe an experience to share. Join us at 1-800-642-1234. And Linda in Madison's online, so let's go to her. Hi, Linda. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I was calling because I was hoping to hear a little more about another unsung hero, Joseph Jackson.
Oh, goodness.
I heard him all in the background, so I just wanted to make sure that he was acknowledged in this program. I love your book.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about the White Knight.
Mm.
This man, Colonel Joseph W. Bud Jackson. Believe me, Larry and Linda, without Olbrich was important, Paul Stark was important, but Olbrich died in 1929. And it was, of course, the beginning, you know, with the crash, and it was the beginning of the Great Depression. The Board of Regents, University of Wisconsin Board of Regents, had agreed in 1927. They passed a resolution that they would accept the deeds to those six parcels of land once it was, you know, the time was right.
Yeah.
Olbrich and Paul Stark hadn't acquired the last parcel. Olbrich dies in 1929, just about the time that the last parcel was acquired. the nation went into the Great Depression, and the whole business of the Arboretum, it was called the Wingra Project, stalled. It was dead in the water until 1930-31, when Paul Stark turned to the White Knight, Bud Jackson. Bud Jackson, who knew Olbrich and was quite impressed with Olbrich and inspired by Olbrich, he had offered to help Olbrich at one point in 1928, as I recall. And Bud Jackson agreed to take up the mantle, Olbrich's mantle. And from that point on, Bud Jackson was the central figure in the history and development of the Arboretum. If Bud Jackson had not decided to take up the responsibility, the Arboretum would probably not be as big as it is now. Definitely wouldn't be. Almost all of the land that was acquired after 1932, when the Board of Regents finally agreed to accept the parcels of land, and that was the date of the founding of the Arboretum. From that date on, all of the land that was acquired by Bud Jackson. Oh. He was amazing, and he was most important, and what a colorful guy.
And was there opposition to establishing that Arboretum?
There wasn't opposition as such. I mean, it wasn't an active attempt to try to stop it. I think the university hesitated to accept the responsibility for this Arboretum. It wasn't the university's idea. It was the idea of Michael Olbrich and Paul Stark. These were Madison businessmen. But they had influence on the Board of Regents. Maurice McCaffrey, for instance, who was the trust officer for university investments, was the secretary of the Board of Regents. And McCaffrey liked the idea of this Wingra project, the possibility of putting in an arboretum. And so when Bud Jackson and Paul Stark decided in 1932 that they wanted to finally approach the Board of Regents and to ask the Board of Regents if they were willing to accept the deeds, they turned to McCaffrey. And McCaffrey was the one who really put the pressure on the Board of Regents to finally convince the Board of Regents that they needed to accept these deeds. They were hesitant. The university was hesitant. There weren't many people in the university who were interested at that point because it was the Depression.
Yeah.
And there was barely enough money to keep the university going, let alone to take on the responsibility now of six parcels of land that really needed to be repaired. That meant they needed to hire people, labor, and that became a big, big issue. Resolved, finally, to the better. I mean, for good, in 1935, when finally they got a contingent of CCC.
And the CCC came in and played a very significant role in the preparation.
Extremely significant, Larry. I'd say if you look around the Arboretum now, most of what you see in the Arboretum, that has any historical dimension was put in by the
Civilian Conservation Corps.
The Civilian Conservation Corps. They came in 1935 and stayed until 1941.
By the way, you can join in if you have a question or comment about the Arboretum as we talk with our guest, author Franklin Court. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. I'd love to hear from you. Or email us at talk@wpr.org. Very early on, I think it became apparent that there were different directions that could be taken by the Arboretum. For example, it could be promoted as a leisure and recreation site for the public, or it could be primarily a research station with limited public access. And it sort of ended up as a combination of those things. But who were the proponents of each over the years, and where did, and how did, explain how it ended up?
Yeah. Well, one of the major players in all of this was Aldo Leopold, who really wanted the Arboretum to be mainly a wildlife refuge.
Mm-hmm.
He was the director of research at the Arboretum. And he was, of course, his background was forestry. He was the professor of game management. And so he promoted the Arboretum as a wildlife refuge. He and Bob McCabe and the people who worked for him as graduate students, they spent a great deal of time over there doing research to try to improve the habitat so that they could attract game birds. The object was to try to teach game cropping eventually to Wisconsin farmers so that they could make extra money or earn extra cash during the Depression. The Depression figures so, you know, largely.
Right.
At the same time, the first chairman of the Arboretum Committee was another unsung hero, Ed Gilbert, who was the chair of the Botany Department. And it was Gilbert who wanted it to be an arboretum. Mm-hmm. He wanted a botanical garden. And that's why Longenecker was hired as became executive director, and he shared the duties of directorship with Leopold. So you had two opposing viewpoints working here. There was the viewpoint represented by Longenecker and Ed Gilbert, which was, let's keep it a botanical garden, let's make it a museum of trees and shrubs. And on the other hand, it was Alder Leopold saying, we want a wildlife refuge. We can have both, they thought. But Madison started to encroach. By the time you get to the 40s, Leopold dies in 1948, and I think Alder Leopold, by the mid-40s, realized that the Arboretum was not going to be a wildlife refuge.
Yeah.
And that's how it's turned out. There is still wilderness there, you know, and a lot of wilderness, but the migratory game birds that used to be there aren't there anymore. But we still have Longenecker Gardens. That's the botanical end of it, the horticultural end. The rest of the Arboretum is a wilderness and a huge nature preserve full of restored native plant communities that appeal. So we've got both things going, but we just don't have the wildlife refuge going that Leopold had hoped. They used to have pheasant roundups, Larry. Get it, pheasant roundups. I haven't seen a pheasant in the Arboretum since I've been volunteering over there. But back in the 40s and as recently as the 50s, they would have pheasant roundups and where they would round up the pheasants to band them. There were so many. They had grouse all over the place. And we still have the wood ducks, but we've lost a lot of the other migratory birds.
Unfortunately. We had a Madison caller. Good. Say that they moved out. The move out day at the university was being yesterday, and move in day was today. They spent the entire day relaxing at the Arboretum.
Yes, I'm not surprised. People do. You should. I work the reception desk out there, Larry, and I want to say that the Arboretum folks talk about the Arboretum itself as a work in progress, or they talk about the plant communities as works in progress. I want to say the Arboretum itself is a work in progress. It's amazing, the people who come and go, and there's always something new out there, always something happening that's different. There's always something changing along with the seasons.
Would you say that early May would be the time when more of the largest number of people visiting?
Certainly. Early May is probably the time when we get most of the people coming to see the display in Longenecker Gardens of the display of the flowering spring plants, the magnolias, all the crab apples, the beautiful crab apples, and then the lilacs. But there, Larry, that's about probably maybe every year in the history of the Arboretum except this one.
Yeah,
because by the middle of April, the magnolias were gone, and the crabs were coming in, and of course the lilacs were late or early.
Were early too.
Early, yeah. Everything was so early that it was, you know, usually it's early May, but this time it would have been also
or April.
Yeah,
more like April. More like it. Genevieve in Madison said she loves the Restored Prairie and the book, and your book does such a great job of laying out the incredible amount of the planning and work that went into it.
Tremendous amount of work, yes. Tremendous amount of work, a lot of frustration. They started, this also was timely, given the summer we've just had. They started putting in that prairie in the summer of 1936. And that's the summer that has been referred to time and again this past summer, because it was also one of the hottest summers that the area had ever experienced. Temperature on July 13th, 1936, reached 108 degrees.
Man.
These guys, the CCC, along with a guy who was directing the work, who was Ted Sperry, He was a prairie ecologist. They started at the north, at the west end, and they started transplanting prairie plants that they found in remnant prairies out in the, you know, the area here, mainly up by the Wisconsin River, by, actually. And Ted Sperry would say that by the end of the summer, beginning of the fall of 1936, they had lost 80% of them.
Yeah.
The same thing was true of 1937. But by 1938, 1939, the transplants started to take. They started to, you know, they were strengthening. They were setting in roots, and Sperry would say that it began to look like a prairie.
Yeah.
They also discovered that they would have better results seeding, and so they started seeding as well. When Curtis took over, John Curtis, which is why you know the prairie is called the Curtis Prairie.
Yeah.
When Curtis took over in 1940, by that time Sperry was about to leave for the service. And Curtis took over the responsibility of keeping the prairie going. His planting technique was a little different, but it was and he was a little more successful. But he didn't have those summers that Sperry and the poor CCC had had.
Yeah.
So that by the time you get to the mid-40s, John Curtis, when he can say, as he looked out on that restored prairie, by God, he said, you know, it does look like a restored prairie. Ted Sperry came back after the war. It's an interesting story. And Ted Sperry was quite pleased with what he saw. People would say, well, isn't that a totally restored prairie? And Ted Sperry would say, well, it's a successfully restored tall grass prairie, but it's not total. And people would ask him why. He would say, because there's no bison.
Oh, man. Stan in Madison has a...
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I did want to bring up some more recent history about the Arboretum. A lot of the viewers may not know, listeners may not be aware of this, but as recently as the mid-90s, an attempt was made to acquire additional land directly south of the Grady Tract. And there were a number of many activists involved in this. I was among them. We tried, that piece of property was the Harlan Sprague Dawley property, which is in the city of Fitchburg. And we tried very vigorously to acquire that property, but we were never successful. And one thing more to mention about an older history, when the Beltline was constructed, an attempt was made by Aldo Leopold to prevent the division of the Arboretum and have the Beltline go around the Grady Tract, rather than go directly across and breaking up the Arboretum into two sections.
Hmm. Comments?
Yeah, interesting. That's very interesting. I guess I don't understand completely why that land wasn't acquired, the land south of the Grady Tract, except that they couldn't raise the money. I think maybe, I don't know if the Stan knows the reason, but I think it was just quite simply that they couldn't raise the money.
They did attempt to get the people in the residence in Fitchburg to have to levy a tax on them I think it was 3 years, $25 a year per piece, per property in the city of Fitchburg, and the residents voted against it 2-1.
Sure.
Thank you very much for calling, Frank. I appreciate your call. You can join in, too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions or comments. What have been the pluses and minuses of the University of Wisconsin the Arboretum being under the control of the University of Wisconsin? Are there pluses and minuses?
One of the biggest pluses is that the University of Wisconsin is still budgeting for it.
Yeah, research done there.
Yeah, we wish they would budget more, and there's a lot of research going on. I'm right now waiting for a little report from a young woman who's doing wonderful research. I'm anxious to find out how she's doing on toads and the sand in the sand prairie down by the south end of sand prairie area down at the southeast end of the Grady Tract. That's down by Green Prairie, and that's very sandy down there. But her research is fascinating, and we're going to find out what she can come up with what results she can come up with on toads and sand and how they cohabit and all that sort of thing, you know, the relationship. So there's still a lot of research going on there, yes. And so that's an advantage. The only disadvantage is comes from the times when the budgets, when the UW budget gets hit. Because when the UW budget gets hit, you know, the Arboretum usually also takes a bit of a hit. And so we've lost staff. And we have lost staff. And that is unfortunate. And I don't think it's necessarily, it's not the UW's fault. It's the fact that there isn't enough money to fund everything that we want, I think, in this vast university complex. And the university, or the Arboretum is, part of the problem.
Jan and Rhinelander, hi, thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. How ironic that I'm just driving down to Madison to visit my son who goes to school down there, and I'm listening to your show. So I'm definitely going to take the Arboretum in tomorrow. I'm going to stay overnight just to do that. So, but my question is, why is the population of the birds, the pheasants, whatever, why is that declining on the Arboretum? Your climate is pretty good down there for pheasant population, I think. I'm just wondering, why is it declining? Because of all the people that come through there, or what's the reason?
Thanks for calling.
Well, that's it primarily. It's the, the birds had a habitat that appealed to them when back in the 40s and the 50s. But that habitat doesn't exist anymore, and part of the reason is because of the city that surrounds the Arboretum now entirely. And it's the birds, the migratory birds, just are no longer simply attracted to the Arboretum as a workable habitat, as an attractive habitat. They go elsewhere, and there's nothing you can do about that.
Yeah.
No, there's nothing we probably could do about it now. We could throw more seed out and try to improve the habitat, but that's not going to make a difference with the birds.
Yeah.
I mean, they're flying over the Beltline. And they're not about to do that, many of those migratory birds. It's just, and the bigger the Beltline gets, the more crowded it gets, the less likely we're going to have migratory birds.
Although I've just, on the other hand, the last few times that I've been to the Arboretum, I think I've seen turkeys.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, we got turkeys.
Those are our wild turkeys, yeah. We have an explosion of wild turkeys there, Larry. So we're no.
Yeah. No shortage of turkeys.
No shortage of turkeys, is right.
There was no shortage of rabbits either.
No, at one time they had a rabbit shoot.
Yeah.
Bob McCabe, who was he was the director of the game management department, wildlife management they called it after Leopold died, but they had so many rabbits they were eating the Arboretum. And so Bob McCabe decided that one way to try to get rid of the rabbits was to have a rabbit shoot. And, well, they started, and that created a lot of problems because some of the people in the area, especially over in the Fitchburg area, didn't like the idea of all those rifles going off in the Arboretum for the rabbit shoot. But we don't, for some reason, this is a nice topic of conversation at the Arboretum. We are at the Arboretum among the folks that work out there. We don't have as many rabbits anymore. And we wonder why, and somebody, the suggestion is, the possibility is, we do have coyotes over there, believe it or not. Yes, there are coyotes in the Arboretum, and we think the coyotes may be keeping the rabbit population in check. So, in a way, God bless the coyotes.
And a couple of deer out there, too.
Oh, we've got more than a couple of deer, yes. That's another explosion. We have to keep the deer under control. The turkeys, though, are fascinating. It's wonderful to have the turkeys. We have sandhill cranes coming through there now, stopping over. We've had mating pairs of sandhill cranes over the past few years.
That is very cool. This is the Arboretum's 80th anniversary.
Yes, it is.
What stands out to you as its legacy and the challenges to come?
I think the legacy is there. It's what it is,
Yeah.
I mean, and it's what it means for the community. It's what it provides in the way of resources for the university and for research itself, you know. I think that's primarily the legacy. The legacy is itself in existence. What's to come? I don't know. I really have no idea. We've been able to maintain the Arboretum in its restored state.
Yeah.
We're finding now, I notice in the prairie, that there's a lot of sumac that's invading. We have invading grasses in the prairies, and so that's a threat. How far mm-hmm. that's going to go? It's reed canary grass.
Yeah,
and it's invading both the Curtis Prairie and the Green Prairie. Mm. We keep trying to get it out. We worry constantly about invasive species. It doesn't mean that there are maybe any more than there were 2 or 3 years ago, but still you worry about that. As the air gets more polluted, maybe it's going to have an effect on the arboretum that's going to be negative.
And finally, many of the people in the book seem so familiar to me because so many of them have streets named after them or...
Oh, yeah.
or pieces of land named after them. And so it's really been an honored group of people, visionaries, that were involved in this. That's what was making it a fun read.
Yes. That's what that was the most interesting part of the research.
Yeah.
Larry, mm-hmm. was dealing with the people and learning about the people. And that was it was fascinating. I enjoyed the research, and I was absolutely happy to have had the opportunity to do it.
Well, you've written a great book, Frank. Thank you so much for coming in and talking with us about it.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you very much for having me.
Franklin Court, our guest, pioneers of ecological restoration, the people and legacy of the University of Wisconsin Arboretum. It's published by the University of Wisconsin Press, and you can find copies. You can find a link to the publisher right on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show. I'm sure it'll be available at your local bookstores.
So, Barnes & Noble, too.
Barnes & Noble
and the University Bookstore.
And the University
Bookstore. Oh, yes.
Thanks again, Frank. We've talked about that rich history of the natural treasure that's the UW Arboretum, but coming up, we're going to take a look at an even older and deeper history, the geology of Wisconsin. Bob Dott and Dave Michelson are emeritus professors of geology at UW-Madison. They're here to tell us about our state's geology and how and where to enjoy it. So stay tuned here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.